Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. Hello, welcome to Art Slice. Today we're going to be covering some artists who had to supplement their practice, finding a living doing commercial illustrations, but they didn't let those commercial boundaries impede on their vision. I'm talking artists like Harry Clark, Wanda Gogh, and maybe, if we get to it, Neera. Their own distinct visual language remained.
Oh, well, if it isn't your old pal, the
Demon Reindeer!
Thought you all, may have forgotten about me. I'm, obviously, being sarcastic, because look at me. I just cannot explain how disappointed
Demon Reindeer,
it's
very good to see you again, but we cannot...
It's been 3 years.
Look, this is not the best way to start this. I know it's been a few years, but...
Three years.
It's Enya. We can't play Enya. Can you just turn down the Enya?
Just forget about the Enya for a second and look at my fur? My fur isn't even smoldering. It's, I don't even know what to call this. What is that? It's damp.
Look, we're really, really sorry, okay? Our jobs, like everyone else's on Earth, got a little crazy, okay? A lot of personal stuff came up.
And I told you how I keep my demon spirits
We're aware.
But also, we had a summer of loud cars.
Due to construction, the house loud.
Was being rerouted through our neighborhood, okay?
Cars. You're going to use the excuse of car, of automobiles.
Like really loud. Like really, really loud.
So loud.
Yeah, it was rattling.
Did you ever think if you just stopped and thought about your old pal, the demon reindeer, once in a while, that he might have helped, that he could have lended a hoof to help? With those loud noises.
You'd kill them.
I'm not opposed.
You don't want to talk about death. No. Let's talk about death, guys. All of a sudden, you all have a shrine to Santa Muerte. I mean, I'm a fan, but I just, what is it? You can't even make time for your old pal, the demon reindeer.
I'm here to make amends. I'm very sorry. Our palms... are outstretched. Your palm is very clammy.
I know.
Yeah, it's probably the dampness. It's the humidity in the room. And once again, we are so sorry.
Obviously, we believe in you.
As damp as you are, we still believe in you. We definitely still believe in you.
Okay, well, I mean, that's a start.
Okay.
Now, if you could be so kind to hand me that towel, something I never thought I'd have to say.
Yeah. Okay.
And let's do... What did you call it now? It's those spooky ones, those spooky episodes.
Oh, the
creature features.
Yeah, they're called creature features.
We actually we're gonna do some listener recommended artists anyway, and they can definitely
be spooky. They could be spooky. We could spookify them. They could be much spookier than we originally intended.
Very spooky.
Hella spooky.
Yeah,
we can do that.
Let me set you up.
All right, listeners. We're covering pestilence.
Once again.
We're covering creepy children.
Once again.
Tuberculosis.
The Enya.
Drownings.
The Enya. I think, it's fine. You know what? It's fine.
Also, folklore, lead poisoning, cats, murder, and did I mention creepy children? All through those illustrators I previously mentioned.
Right.
As an aside, we did get a little carried away after watching Dairy Girls
I think you got
doing
carried away, not me.
Irish accents, Northern Irish accents. So if you don't like that kind of stuff,
feck off.
This episode is not for you.
Right.
Okay. But if you are Irish, we respect you. We love you.
We love you.
Please send us your best.
It's an American
accent.
It's an endearment.
But also just your best.
It's an accent of endearments.
Let's get into it.
Lock the doors, lock the windows, hide under the covers, don't look behind you, because
Art Slice
is a creature, some of you.
about to begin. Remember,
In 1913, Harry Clark found himself in a long stay in London, seeking work in the golden age of beautifully illustrated luxury gift books, following in the footsteps of one of his patron saints, the now 15 years deceased via tuberculosis, Aubrey Beardsley, who had found his fame illustrating Oscar Wilde's bloody and sensual play, Salome. Harry, whose work was already drawing comparisons to Beardsley, could surely find the same success. Wrong. He would carry his portfolio and his shy, delicate fingers from publisher to publisher.
And this wasn't like submitting your work to some online portal. You went with your human body and human sensitivities to actual people who may or may not have tuberculosis, unlike today, taking in, immersing yourself in their mouth smells.
And they would reject you to your face with said mouth smells.
Yeah, no ghosting, no AI automatic denial filtering, no gently worded generic email.
Two publishers turned into five, and then eight, and then 10, and then 12. I ran out of fingers. 12 rejections. Okay. He couldn't believe it. Illustrators were getting paid to make those luxury gift books, right? Okay. Some far less talented than him. Perhaps his work was seen as too close to Beardsley. Perhaps the Art Nouveau flavor was waning. Maybe their rosters were full. He decides to try one last time, his 13th try, where he meets George Harrop of House of Harrop Publications, who couldn't believe it. Quote, "He came into my room late in the afternoon, slim, pale, and youthful, with the air of one who has had rebuffs. He opened his portfolio very shyly, with delicate fingers, as he drew out his lovely drawings. It was the final throw of the dice, and but for me, so he said, he probably would have abandoned the idea of illustrating books. It is a happy reflection that I owe my later friendship with Clark to my decision that afternoon to commit my firm to a major book of the character that is usually entrusted only to artists who have arrived." Harry was first given a commission to illustrate Hans Christian Andersen's imaginative fantasy world, like The Little Mermaid and The Emperor's New Clothes. But while Harry was melding his language with HCA's, he had another writer in mind, one that suited his sensibilities for, as one critic described, quote, "the poisonous beauty of fungi." Edgar Allan Poe.
Believe it or not, OG emo dark goth Poe had run in artist circles. He was a fan of the Hudson River School painters. I know, it seems like a weird choice for Edgar Allan Poe. He even worked with illustrators early on in his career, and he seemed to understand the artist eye and the importance of manipulating forms and colors, turning messes of marks into the ethereal and the transcendent. He built his worlds on soundscapes, senses, transitional moments, and lyrical mark-making that can build crystal-clear, haunting images or suspense through murky images, much like the best paintings. And it's why his work is often described as graphical or arabesque.
Two words that fit Harry Clark's imagery to a T.
Like Poe, Harry's work can weave and wind into a larger matrix, which can be taken in as a singular image, overflowing with details that builds to a strangely harmonious cacophony. Or it can be observed in the micro, taken apart for all of its pieces, observed with a magnifying glass, hundreds of tiny compositions that comprise the whole.
You can imagine a young, shy Harry locked away in his room, pouring through pages as his own interpretations of Poe's nihilistic and devilishly humorous worlds accumulate into form, projections filtered and built through Harry's own experiences. Next up in our double feature, listeners, we're going to start with an illustrated tale by Irish illustrator and stained glasser Harry Clark, who was introduced to us by Sophia at He Mare Comic, and we got some help from Michael Reinsch at Reinsch.
Well, I'm going to put it on the screen.
Bless you, Michael.
Bless you, Michael. Sophia. Thank you so much. And over a year ago, I think both of them. So yes. Thank you. That shows you how late we are often with these. It's
we
okay.
hang on, though.
We hang on. We're still there. We're still thinking about it. We're mulling it over.
Corazón, okay? Yeah.
Our corazones are mulling. They're mulling like a wine, like mulled wine.
And only you're richer with time.
See.
With time. So here is our Art Slice abbreviated version of an Edgar Allan Poe tale, a pestilence. King Pest, y'all.
King Pest.
Let me prepare my Edgar Allan Poe voice here. The voice that is synonymous with Edgar Allan Poe. Excuse me.
Careful.
Thank you. Like I gotta get to my page. King Pest. King James version. And not NIV. All right.
About 12 o'clock, one night in the month of October, and during the chivalrous reign of the third Edward, two seamen belonging to the crew of the Free and Easy were much astonished to find themselves seated in the taproom of an alehouse, which alehouse bore for sign of a jolly tar. The room, although ill-contrived, smoke-blackened, low-pitched, and in every other respect agreeing with the general character of such places of the period, was, nevertheless, in the opinion of the grotesque group scattered here and there within it, sufficiently well adapted to its purpose.
To me, they just seem like they're working class, Edgar. Like, yeah. Don't judge. Like, it's a hard life out there, wrangling sure. crabs for your fucking cakes, your crab cakes and your Old Bay martinis, Edgar. They're probably drinking to counteract the equilibrium shock of going from land to sea. Going from land to sea, that happens a lot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, you got
to
get your land legs.
Yeah, you got to get your land legs. That's why they call it land legs. Sea legs, land legs, whatever.
Legs.
Anyway, nevertheless, no, nevermore.
Of these groups, our two seamen formed, I think, the most interesting, if not the most conspicuous. The one who appeared to be the elder, whom his companion addressed by the characteristic appellation of legs, was much the taller of the two. He might have measured 6 feet and a half, and an habitual stoop, the necessary consequence of an altitude so enormous. He was exceedingly thin, with high cheekbones, a large hawk nose, retreating chin, fallen under jaw, and huge protruding white eyes.
So the way that Harry has depicted him, listeners, he looks like a longer, skinnier, more tireder version of El Chavo del Ocho.
El Chavo!
But he has a folksier hat, okay?
Yeah.
And he's got a little cropped jacket, and he's got that little bow that hangs from the brim of his hat, like a little bow peep. It's really cute. It's cute.
His pants are also pretty sequin-esque, you know what I mean? They're sequin parachute, I think. Sequin parachute pants.
He's ahead of his times.
The younger seaman was the converse of his companion. His stature could not have exceeded 4 feet. A pair of stumpy bow legs supported his squat, unwieldy figure, while his unusually short and thick arms swung off dangling from his sides like the fins of a sea turtle. Small eyes of no particular color twinkled far back in his head. His nose remained buried in the mass of flesh which enveloped his round, full, and purple face.
You know what's really twinkling here is a little tarpaulin's coat. Just made of the same fabric as Legs sequin parachute pants.
He's also got some like, what are they called? E-girl tall socks. The E-girl who's the one who sold her bathwater like 20 years ago. That reference is, like I said, 20 years too late.
I used to wear E-girl socks.
Did you sell your bathwater?
No.
Okay.
Well, I didn't have a bathtub.
Maybe we'd be doing a little better then.
It was a cute look. Okay. The socks, not the bathwater.
Yeah.
It was a cute look.
All right, right.
Yeah. For me. For me.
For you.
For me.
Not for me.
For moi. Well, you never wore them, did you? Do you have a secret life that involves e-girl socks that I don't know about?
Possibly. But basically, the little tarpaulin and legs, are time travelers. So they're going back to like the malls in the 2008 era.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, they are
splashing
ahead of their
bath
time.
Water on faces.
That's disgusting.
Grabbing whatever they can off the racks.
They're bad boys. Weird bad boys.
Yeah.
In their own weird bad boy way.
And his thick upper lip rested upon the still thicker one beneath, with an air of complacent self-satisfaction, much heightened by the owner's habit of licking them at intervals. Various and eventful, however, had been the peregrinations of the worthy couple in and about the different tap-houses of the neighborhood during the early hours of the night. Funds, even the most ample, are not always everlasting, and it was with empty pockets our friends had ventured upon the present hostelry.
A.K.A. They ain't paying for
they
that
ain't paying
drink.
For that fucking beer. They ain't paying for that feckin' beer, are they? The feckin' beer, the Guinness, no.
Wait, can I say something? Your cadence is very Irish. The way you've been reading it in English is very Irish.
I've been watching too many Derby Girls. You've been making me watch
Derby Girls?
The Derby Girls. Whatever, Derby Girls.
You're
the roller Derby
Girls.
Derby. They get on their skates. They roll around Ireland, don't they? Chasing wee leprechauns in their skates.
Aye.
Pushing them against the walls. The side rail things in the auditorium thing. The racetrack thing.
It's time to close your hole.
Close my hole. You can kiss my hole. So Lake says to Little Tarplin, he says,
pump ship, clew up all sail, and scud before the wind. Having accordingly disposed of what remained of the ale, they finally made a bolt for the street. Although Tarpaulin rolled twice into the fireplace, mistaking it for the door, half after 12 o'clock, found our heroes ripe for mischief and running for life down a dark alley, hotly pursued by the landlady of the Jolly Tar. The city was in a great measure depopulated. All England, but more especially the metropolis, resounded with the fearful cry of plague. By authority of the king, such districts were placed under ban. Yet neither the mandate of the monarch, nor the huge barriers erected at the entrances of the streets, nor the prospect of that loathsome death prevented the unfurnished and untenanted dwellings from being stripped of every article such as iron, brass, or leadwork, which could in any manner be turned to a profitable account. But there were very few of the terror-stricken people who attributed these doings to the agency of human hands. Pest spirits, plague goblins, fever demons were the popular imps of mischief. In scrambling down an alley, Legs and the worthy Hugh Tarpaulin found their progress suddenly impeded. To return was out of the question, and no time was to be lost, as their pursuers were close upon their heels. Had they not indeed been intoxicated beyond moral sense, their reeling footsteps must have been palsied by the horrors of their situation. The air was cold and misty. The paving stones, loosened from their beds, lay in wild disorder amid the tall, rank grass. The most fetid and poisonous smells everywhere prevailed. But it lay not in the power of images or sensations to stay the course of men.
Drunk, he means drunk, like they're plastered out of their feckin' minds.
Fuckface.
Okay, this chase scene goes on for a while. I'm just gonna kind of go through it here. Let's skip ahead a little bit. Chase scene goes on. Okay, once again, all right.
As the seamen stumbled against the entrance of a tall and ghastly-looking building, a yell, more than usually shrill from the throat of the excited Legs, was replied to from within, in a rapid succession of wild, laughter-like, and fiendish shrieks. The drunken couple rushed headlong against the door, burst it open, and staggered into the midst of things with a volley of curses. The room within which they found themselves proved to be the shop of an undertaker. But an open trapdoor in a corner of the floor near the entrance looked down upon a long range of wine cellars. In the middle of the room stood a table, in the center of which again arose a huge tub of what appeared to be punch. Around it, upon coffin trestles, was seated a company of six. This company I will endeavor to delineate one by one.
Okay. Before we get any further into King Pest, let's get into the artist who, 84 years later, would illustrate this tale so frighteningly well. The Irish artist, illustrator, and master stained glasser, Harry Clark, was auspiciously born on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 1889, in Dublin, Ireland.
Dublin.
Which was first settled by Vikings, and it literally translates to black pool, as in a dirty ass lake.
I mean, it's probably because there's like too many Guinnesses in that lake, right? There's people, first of all, there's people, they don't want to drink Guinness. Guinness is really just like, have you had a Guinness? Have you had a Guinness, love?
No.
It's like have you had a Reuben sandwich?
Yes,
it's a Reuben sandwich, but also kind of a beer. Reuben sandwich, but also kind of a beer. So people admittedly don't actually like it. So they just pour it into that lake. Guinness.
Oh, I see.
The Guinness black.
Like,
yeah, like everybody, everybody take a drink.
So yummy.
Yeah.
I've never done that before. The combination of Nordic and local mythology meant that there was a long lineage of magical fairies gods and goddesses to choose from.
Changelings, leprechauns, kelpies, muckies, anything that suited the landscape of the emerald, green, grass, rainbows, turquoise coastlines, and craggy shores of Ireland. Unlike their black forested, Autobonic, Germanic, folkloric neighbors that inspired Vonda Gogh to be podcasted
right.
in our next podcast.
Yes. Ireland was one of good old Britain's very first colonies in the 12th century. As we know with Mexican artists we have covered, colonization cannot stamp out ancient beliefs. They find ways to persist. And like Mexico, and even in our last episode on Mongol Zurag, the Irish would rediscover their Celtic past in the late 1800s, ushering in an Irish Renaissance, aka the Celtic Revival, which would spark so much great art, but would also be one of the many catalysts for the Irish War of Independence.
Harry himself would come of age in the middle of the Celtic Revival, which cross-pollinated with other popular discoveries and movements around this time, the rediscovery of medieval art, the Gothic art revival, the arrival of ukiyo-e prints in Europe, Art Nouveau, the arts and crafts movement, and of course, the Glasgow School. The Celtic Revival was not only a radical call to rediscover and celebrate their heritage, but like those other movements, it rejected budding, mass-produced craft and design spurred on by industrialization and emphasized a return to the more naturalistic, the handmade, the folksy. In the case of Ireland and Scotland, often featuring specific motifs like Celtic braids and knotworks.
We covered a bit of this in our creature feature with Margaret MacDonald McIntosh, where the spook school was a sharp contrast to the fussy, dusty, crusty Victorian design that had reigned supreme. This is kind of the Irish side of that.
Yeah, so if you're worried about a rise of AI work, keep in mind there's always opportunity for that pendulum to swing back, right?
Be the change you want to see in the world.
Yeah, said Gandhi, right? Yeah, I mean, strap down an AI and let the sharp pendulum swing back and forth until all its wires are all severed and shit.
Bye.
You know, there's like little nano rats crawling up, sucking up the wire juice.
Okay.
Out of the wires.
Love that.
But this is a reference to The Pit and the Pendulum by Edgar Allan Poe and Gandhi. Ghostwritten Gandhi. Edgar Allan Poe on the ledger, ghostwritten Gandhi. Don't check the dates.
You heard it here first. You heard it here first. Okay. Unlike many of his peers, Harry's work's distinctive vibras was popular enough to last long after the heyday of those movements. He would run in the same circles as many of the other Irish Revival artists, writers, playwrights, actors, even attending the same Jesuit school as James Joyce, who described it as, quote, a place where young boys are terrorized by stories of tortures in hell.
Okay.
This is too long for me to do. I'm in hell. Okay. Yeah. I'm burning up. Quote, a place where young boys are terrorized by stories of tortures in hell for those who sinned and especially for those who were sexually prurient.
Yeah, you can tell because those people are wearing ascots. Those are the boys in ascots.
The boys in ascots.
The boys in ascots. And this sparked...
It's like a band name.
Exactly. This sparked a certain fascination with Harry, with the terrors of damnation. Saying that the Jesuit priests gave him a grim understanding of the quality of hell and an idealized version of an improbable paradise.
Mm.
His conflicting feelings about the church and the deeper mysteries of religion and the terrors of damnation, as well as those fairy tales, all likely played a role in the lurid, fluid, and esoteric imagery that Harry would create with both pen and acid-stained glass. Hello, testing.
Hello.
Testing.
Hello.
Testing.
Hi.
We haven't, I don't think we've been here in a minute.
We have not. Listeners, we'd like to interrupt this episode to do some house cleaning. First up, we want to tell you, nay, encourage you to check out two different but very connected communicative exhibitions at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas, that focus on Indigenous work, past, present, and historic. The exhibition, American Sunrise, features new works by Native artists ranging from traditional mediums like basketry, beadwork, and pottery, but also more contemporary forms like painting, photography, and installation. One that the second exhibition, Knowing the West, grounds by giving historic examples of how Native Americans were perceived by Western artists and how their own Indigenous traditions adapted and bloomed despite decades of displacement and oppression. They both speak to this greater, almost cosmic history, and between the two, carry this amazing story.
We caught the artist talk for American Sunrise, and it was so amazing. Like I was pretty dumbfounded. And there's always so much to do out there. The Momentary, another museum in that area, has a show that's not based on Best in Show, as in the movie with the dogs with Parker Posey.
We met at Starbucks. Not at the same Starbucks, but we saw each other at different Starbucks across the street.
But it is about show dogs. Like, it's a good weekend trip. Hike some trails, have some coffee, look at some art.
Knowing the West will run until January 27, so you don't have too much longer to check it out. Meanwhile, American Sunrise will be open until March 23rd.
The museums are free, including American Sunrise. I think Knowing the West is a special exhibition, so there might be a small fee associated with that. But it's like less than a movie ticket. Well worth it.
And I know that sometimes I'd be in one Starbucks and then you'd be in the other Starbucks.
We also want to shout out our newest patrons. We've had some come, we've had some go, but we really appreciate all of you supporting us, even though we have had a very, very hectic release schedule the last 2 years. So we're really sorry that our jobs are D-U-M-B.
They're dumb.
Dumb. They're dumb. So dumb.
Yeah.
So dumb. But anyway, welcome new patrons. Sophia, Scott, Shivranyani, Megan, Elise, and Maya.
All the patron support is really, really helpful. We recently, like, one of our computers died, so we had to go get a Mac Mini, and we didn't know how we were going to come up with the money. And what was that? Oh, we had all that money from Patreon to pay for, like, a portion of it. So we really, really appreciate it.
And, oh my
Working
gosh.
Working on my Mac.
And I had my Mac.
If you don't want to deal with, like, a reoccurring subscription, buying some merch almost nets us about the same amount as a $2 patron donates per year. So you can get yourself a t-shirt at artslicepod.com. We got a new one, like Posada's Calavera, but a ripoff on an ICP shirt as an Insane Clown Posse. A shirt that is probably so specific, Stephanie, that it only, the Venn diagram of people that would be interested in it is specifically me. Just basically applies to me.
You don't know that. Also, we could use your algorithmic help. Okay, they really are a pain in the ass.
The A double money signs.
More, yes, exactly.
If you're a podcast listener only, if you have a moment, open your laptop, your phone, whatever, play our episodes on YouTube and leave us a comment or two on them. Maybe, you know, it could be a smiley face. It could be a little heartsy. It could be like a little hi, how are you doing sort of situation. That would help us grow over there, I think. I think. Sure. This is a weird thing, but I think, you know, watching it and commenting helps, and subscribing if you haven't done that. It's annoying. But we would truly appreciate that. And we will respond to you, unless you're an asshole.
Also, you could leave a 5-star review on your favorite pod player like Kay Salem just did. Quote, sometimes you need something silly. 5 stars. This podcast gives me a much-needed escape when I'm working. I love the artists that they cover, and I learn so many new things every episode. Thank you, Kay.
Special K. Yeah.
Thank you.
Like the cereal.
Exactly. It's
but good
for
reviews.
You.
Special K good for you?
Yeah.
Probably is.
Why?
It's probably better for you than most things. Yeah.
This Special K is good for us. In
yes,
the meantime, listeners, please, please, please take care of yourselves and each other.
Art, at the very least, is incredibly therapeutic, so don't let all the noise take that away from you. No. Right. Unless it's our noise. Okay. Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
We forgot how to do these, I think.
Bye.
Bye.
I know. It's so stupid
now.
It's
so good.
Oh.
That's right, and I thought that was really sexy.
Yeah.
I was drinking cappuccino.
I remember.
Harry's Da, Joshua Clark, was an English transplant and a commercial artist, working most of his life under British occupation. He managed a studio known for their Britfluenced church ornaments, as in giant ornaments. Mm. Joshua had married an Irish gal, Bridget.
All the Gaelic siren song of a Gaelic redhead lass, whose eyes twist and contort into a Lovecraftian smile.
Don't it, love? It's time to shut your hole.
They'll
break his my hole.
Okay. Okay. Speaking of holes, they had 2 daughters, Catherine and Dolly, and another boy, Walter, besides Harry. When Harry was born, he was named not Howard, but Henry, and somehow that turned into Harry.
Sometimes I feel like our jokes are just us, like, writing checks to bad reviews for the future and just, like, leaving them on park benches under rocks, just unsigned.
Check
bad review. oh, when's that check going to clear?
Henry somehow turned into Harry.
Okay. Well, it wasn't because of his face. I mean, check out those baby smooths back there. Those baby smoothie cheekies. Smooth. Yeah, smoothie, smooth. Smoothie cheeky babies.
Yes. So, on a sadder note, Harry's mother would pass away in 1903 from tuberculosis when he was just 14. Devastating.
It's a good thing we don't have to worry about tuberculosis anymore, Stephanie, and that's all tied up and nothing to worry about anymore. Glad there's not a huge outbreak in the state that we live in. Glad we're not terrorized by the thought of getting tuberculosis anytime we see some sticky-fingered, gross little child at Costco running around just free looking for Pokemon cards, asking people about Pokemon cards. With breakfast pizza shit just smeared on their face because they give out samples.
It's not like that. Not like
you have to dodge them. Okay. You have to dodge them with your cart and try not to run them over, even though you want to. You kind of like turn it to run them over, but you don't want to. You can't do it. You can't do it, but you want to.
It's time to pause your hole.
Kiss my hole.
Okay. All right. So, like their ma, Harry and his brother would also suffer from poor health their entire lives. Mm. In 1904, the third Irish Arts and Crafts Exhibition held in Dublin featured stained glass, and Joshua thought, I'm so bleeding sick of ornaments. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, ornaments. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, ornaments. Sunday, ornaments. Christmas, bleeding ornaments. And he says to Harry, he says, boyo, let's get into that stained glass game.
They're on the cutting edge.
So, Da Joshua sent the young, oft ill, and very shy Harry, who spent his time nosing a sketchbook, to a design school in London. Mm. But London was not for the fresh-faced, smoothie-faced Harry. Okay, so back to Dublin it was, back to the Dublin Metropolitan School of Art, studying while also working in his Da's studio, training in stained glass.
And chain-smoking. Training in chain-smoking.
It's possible that the oft-ill Harry would be made more ill by all of the chemicals used in stained glass making.
And all the chained smoking.
Illness would finally catch up to the now 19-year-old Harry, where he would undergo the first of many nose-related surgeries he would have in his lifetime, limiting him to nearly half the year in bed, doing nothing but drawing, making decorative cutouts.
And mouth breathing.
And reading, that's true.
Lots of mouth breathing.
That's true. Once he was well enough to leave his bed, he wanted to get as far away from it as possible.
The room, it probably smelled like a freshly removed cast after he left, being in there for so long with mouth breathing.
That's generous. I would have said something way worse. Harry, along with his art school chum and fellow illustrator Austin Molloy, would make the first of many, many journeys to the Aran Islands off the northwest Irish mainland.
While the crisp Atlantic air was recommended to aid his chemical-filled lungs in their recovery, Aran would actually prove to be a continual source of escape and constant influence. And Aran's a weird one, folks. Like, we really need to go to Aran Island. I need to see this.
Yes, please.
The shifting weather, the sheer cliffs, the unnerving absence of trees due to the lack of topsoil, maze-like, oddly stacked stone walls everywhere, traces of pagan-influenced Catholic iconography, agricultural wee folk running around chasing sheep, probably yelling at them in Gaelic. The island's unique location also supports a vast variety of flora that can be found in the Arctic, Mediterranean, and Alpine regions, growing together, side by side. Insane.
In the membrane.
Insane. The Aran Islands were considered a mecca of sorts, a source of primal inspiration during the Celtic revival. He would return there annually with other art chums, and even on his honeymoon with his life chum, Margaret Crilly, another artist he met at the Dublin Metro School, spending their days filling their sketchbooks to the brim with the magical landscape of Aran, soaking in the local folk art, all while dressed in white wool felt suits and red rawhide shoes called Pamputis.
As seen in Sean Keating's portrait of Harry in St. Kevin's Church. So all of that was one of many things that would feed into Harry's future work.
A channeling of a world beyond the periphery of our vision.
If only the Aran rocks could speak.
And they would say, Harry looked weird in those Pamputis. It just wasn't working for him. It just didn't work. It didn't match his whole thing.
It wasn't for you, lad. It wasn't for you, lad.
It's a wee bit off, isn't it?
Harry took on a huge role in his dad's business, winning awards and scholarships for his stained glass commissions, mostly for churches, which he used to spend time soaking up Gothic and medieval stained glass work all across Europe. And while we are focusing on his illustrative work today, we have to mention that the gorgeous stained glass work he became legendary for evolved with his freaky, not at all religious illustration work.
In time, Harry would innovate the stained glass medium itself, making them appear as glowing versions of his illustrations, using unconventional lead lines, etching specially made sand and kelp glass with acid and gradations of color within those panes, instead of segmenting them as solid colors. I mean, these are really, really, and I mean really technically phenomenal works.
His Geneva window, made late in his short career, is by far the pinnacle of his skills, and they deserve a whole episode in their own right.
Definitely, definitely. But what is interesting about the Geneva window is that they are completely secular. They are not religious, focusing on important figures in literature and another great love of his life, the theater.
If he could help it, he never missed a show at the famous Abbey Theater, getting to know the actors and playwrights and even attending rehearsals.
Mm. Staring pensively through his baby smooth cheeks, you know, kind of creating like this weird mirror proscenium stage inverted reflection on his cheeks with also the nose and the eyes like kind of inverted in it.
Sounds like one of his drawings, kind of. When you first look at Harry Clark's Geneva window or his illustration work, you might immediately think of Aubrey Beardsley's work. Erotic, gorgeous, and grotesque, beautifully balanced between active and negative space, utilizing flowing design lines to pull it all together. And certainly, Harry was, like many of his artist chums, heavily influenced by Beardsley.
But for all the similarities, Harry's work has this like intangible quality that sets it apart and is really, really fecking hard to nail down. For one thing, his work was grittier than Beardsley. We described his work in our Purple episode as taking that sinewy Art Nouveau line work and pushing it through a tuberculosis fever dream, much like those Play-Doh things that you push down on it, pushes it through the little shit. Okay. Which is our way of saying that he was spinning through his Rolodex of different influences.
There are echoes of this in the first wave of Celtic Revival artists who makes proto-Renaissance work, think of artists like Botticelli, with fantastical and organically designed medieval works like the Book of Kells.
The influence of Gothic Revival in both literature, you can see it in Poe's painterly language, right? And in architecture, like the overly ornate buttresses and duchesses, and whatever, it's just, this is, the contrast of pure darkness versus pops of intricately detailed light might explain why his work overflows with so much visual information. Of course, there's also the arts and crafts movement in the Glasgow School are also floating around in that spinning Rolodex, but just guessing here, the influence of theater, that is where we think Harry found something that truly makes his work stand apart.
Of the few photos that exist of Harry Clark, there is one where he is a loin cloth holding onto, I don't know, a clothing line, standing on his tippy toes, on his tippy toes. The very shy Harry looks confidently and, dare I say, seductively at the camera while posing as Jesus nailed to the cross, which he used as a reference for a stained glass commission at St. Joseph's Church.
So when you think of that church, when you go to that church, when you visit that church, you see that beautiful Jesus up there, that Jesus up there, nailed to the cross. Think of old Harry in a loincloth.
Okay.
Smooth-faced. Baby-cheeked.
Okay.
Smooth-bodied.
All right.
Baby-bodied. Not baby-bodied. No. He has a normal body. Regular body.
Okay. Enough about his body. Yeah.
But it's a glimpse into what the sausage is made out of, what the Rolodex is made out of, which is sausage. It's a sausage Rolodex made of sausages, not a Rolodex of sausage companies and recipes.
Okay.
Those could be in a sausage-based Rolodex, though I'm not sure if I'm being clear. But the sausage points back to Harry's North Star, the theater love. The figures he would depict in both his illustrations and later, more creatively ambitious stained glass show often androgynous figures stretching and contorting their bodies in elaborate costuming, projecting over-exaggerated expressions, navigating fantastical, ornate environments from one point of the stage to another.
Like walking this way while someone gestures and gives a soliloquy upstage.
And that means that the compositions are often in that proscenium view as well. Harry's gorgeous static of patterning, negative shapes, and Aaron Flora-inspired vignettes can start to seem like cutout stage props. And similar to the stage, it's easy to be like swept up and suspend any disbelief, snuggling into that magical reality.
It's also not difficult to imagine the stagehands tearing these scenes away as the story moves forward. So we're kind of talking about Harry's past and future all at once, right? But at this time, in 1913, Harry's work was that stained glass.
The bleeding edge, love.
Religious commissions, yeah. Yes. And this kept his inclination for the fantastical and grotesquical in check.
But as a critic would point out, his art was so full of imagination and personality, it risked never being realized by sticking with commissions only from ecclesiastical patrons.
Luckily, we think, the wealthy, eccentric, 20-stone Lawrence Ambrose Waldron, or Larky,
right.
would take the thin, quiet-spoken Harry under his decidedly not-so-pious wing, introducing him to the paganistic, seedy Dublin underbelly. Dublinelli.
I like that.
Larky not only hooks up Harry with secular and oft-risque commissions, but he introduces him to important folks in said Dublin underbelly art circles. Dublinelli art circles. Artists, writers, and art lovers gathered regularly at his mansion, which had plenty of room and rooms for decadent, extravagant, and honestly, how is it described in those old-ass books? Like, Eyes Wide Shut meets Arabor.
Oh.
Arabor, yeah. Those two together. So young, baby-faced Harry now has connections and now has seen this secret, decadent, hedonistic world that existed amongst the wealthy, and it maybe, just maybe, served as an inspiration for future illustrations, which would soon evolve into their final form, capturing the opulent and the lurid, as gorgeous as they are toxic.
Fronting the entrance and elevated a little above his companions sat a personage who appeared to be the president of the table. His stature was gaunt and tall, and legs was confounded to behold in him a figure more emaciated than himself. This gentleman was clothed from head to foot in a richly embroidered black silk velvet pall, wrapped negligently around his form after the fashion of a Spanish cloak. His head was stuck full of sable hearse plumes, which he nodded to and fro with a jaunty and knowing air. And in his right hand he held a huge human thigh bone. His face was as yellow as saffron, forehead so unusually and hideously lofty as to have the appearance of a bonnet superadded upon the natural head.
I love that. Saffron yellow complexion.
Yeah,
love
it's just jaundice from all the turmeric double IPAs. he's Mars Attack, but in a Homer's Moo Moo.
But over said Moo Moo, KP, King Petulance, is draped with a pitch black, almost void-like cape, accenting his pesty neck, with a collar that looks like it's made out of a row of cheese slices or like a honeycomb party decoration. You know, they like...
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I guess so.
And then a handful of large dispersed daisies together with the scotch rim. They help us see how far his pesty cape is reaching.
Right.
His mouth was puckered and dimpled into an expression of ghastly affability, and his eyes, as indeed the eyes of all the table, were glazed over with the fumes of intoxication. Opposite him was a lady of no whit the less extraordinary character. She was evidently in the last stage of a dropsy.
She dropsied her plate of noodles on her face and body. She's a mess.
Yeah.
And her figure resembled nearly that of the huge puncheon of October beer, which stood with the head driven in close by her side in a corner of the chamber. Her face was exceedingly round, red, and full.
A lot of full faces around here.
Some full faces here.
Tarpaulin immediately observed each individual person of the party, every one of whom seemed to possess a monopoly of some particular portion of physiognomy. This portion proved to be the mouth. Commencing at the right ear, it swept with a terrific chasm to the left.
That's one of those Terry Gilliam, circa Brazil, circa Hot Hot Heat facelifts sort of situations, you know, where they pull it back.
Trust you, though.
She made, however, every exertion to keep her mouth closed and look dignified. At her right hand sat a diminutive young girl whom she appeared to patronize. This delicate little creature, in the trembling of her wasted fingers, in the livid hues of her lips, and in the slight hectic spot which tinged her otherwise leaden complexion, gave evident indications of a galloping consumption. She wore, in a graceful and dégagé manner, a large and beautiful winding sheet of the finest India lawn. Her hair hung in ringlets over her neck. A soft smile played about her mouth, but her nose, extremely long, thin, sinuous, flexible, and pimpled, hung down far below her underlip, and in spite of the delicate manner in which she now and then moved it to one side or the other with her tongue, gave to her countenance a somewhat equivocal expression.
I love that Harry has depicted her as kind of like an elderly, out-of-work drag queen.
Yeah, Harry's got that flair for androgyny.
Me gusta.
Over against her, and upon the left of the dropsical lady, was seated a little puffy, wheezing, and gouty old man, whose cheeks reposed upon the shoulders of their owner.
He looks like just a pile of face. Also, but like a pile of vegetables and toilet paper.
Okay. Chunky vegetables, toilet paper.
Chunky pile.
Yeah, just a garbage pail kid of grossness.
With his arms folded and with one bandaged leg deposited upon the table, he seemed to think himself entitled to some consideration. He evidently prided himself much upon every inch of his personal appearance, but took more especial delight in calling attention to his gaudy coloured surtout. Next to him was a gentleman in long white hose and cotton drawers. His frame shook in a ridiculous manner with a fit of what Tarpaulin called the horrors.
He's wrapped himself in lettuce leaves. Yeah. Keep his skin moist.
Yeah, it's good. It's exfoliating. It's great. Keeps the moisture in. It's like collagen.
His jaws, which had been newly shaved, were tightly tied up by a bandage of muslin, and his arms, being fastened in a similar way at the wrists, prevented him from helping himself too freely to the liquors upon the table. A pair of prodigious ears, nevertheless, which it was no doubt found impossible to confine, towered away into the atmosphere of the apartment, and were occasionally pricked up at the sound of the drawing of a cork. Sixthly.
I didn't know we did sixthly.
Sixthly, and lastly, was situated a singularly stiff-looking personage. He was habited, somewhat uniquely, in a new and handsome mahogany coffin. Its top, or headpiece, pressed upon the skull of the wearer and extended over it in the fashion of a hood, giving to the entire face an air of indescribable interest. A pair of huge goggle eyes rolled up their awful whites towards the ceiling in absolute amazement at their own enormity.
He has those bubbles from being drunk, you know, in the cartoons, and like half-drooped eyelids.
Okay.
Pretty good.
Yes.
Looks like he's been hit, you know, by something from Acme Packing Company a few times.
Before each of the party lay a portion of a skull, which was used as a drinking cup. Overhead was suspended a human skeleton, by means of a rope tied round one of the legs and fastened to a ring in the ceiling. The other limb, confined by no such fetter, stuck off from the ceiling at right angles, causing the whole loose and rattling frame to dangle and twirl about at the caprice of every occasional puff of wind which found its way into the apartment. In the cranium of this hideous thing lay a quantity of ignited charcoal, which threw a fitful but vivid light over the entire scene.
This is the part of the illustration that sold this piece for me. It's so subtle. At first, it looks like it's just some weird decorative comet some high schooler made on a scratch board during first period. But it's this hidden calavera from out of the frame with glowing eyes casting a coal light.
The arm is hanging to with one of its fingers up, like, hey, I got a moment to say something into the scene.
Excuse me, King Pest.
Legs, leaning against the wall, dropped his lower jaw still lower.
Still lower. Lower. Lower.
It hurt.
Lower.
It hurt.
Jaw still lower than usual, and spread open his eyes to their fullest extent. Hugh Tarpaulin, stooping down so as to bring his nose upon a level with the table, burst into a long, loud, and obstreperous roar of very ill-timed and immoderate laughter. Without, however, taking offence at behaviour so excessively rude, the tall president smiled very graciously upon the intruders, nodded to them in a dignified manner with his head of sable plumes. It becomes our duty upon the present happy occasion.
Legs and little tarpy, they like interrupt him a bunch, of course, but he's pleasant. King Pest is pleasant. He goes on.
King Pleasant.
I am monarch, and here rule with undivided empire under the title King Pest the First. The noble lady who sits opposite is Queen Pest, our serene consort. The other exalted personages whom you behold under the respective titles of...
Jesus.
Of...
His Grace the Archduke Pestiferous, His Grace the Duke Pestistential, His Grace the Duke Tempest, and Her Serene Highness the Archduchess Anapest. We are here this night, prepared by deep research and accurate investigation to examine, analyze, and thoroughly determine the indefinable spirit of those inestimable treasures of the palate, the wines, ales, and liquors of this goodly metropolis, to advance not more our own designs than the true welfare of that unearthly sovereign whose reign is over us all, whose dominions are unlimited, and whose name is Death.
So, basically, listeners, our two heroes, our seamen, are getting drunk at a bar.
Seamen's.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Okay. Our seamen's are getting drunk at a bar. They haphazardly drink and dash and serpentine across barricades, thank you, into a quarantine area of London to escape their creditors. I don't blame them. I hate creditors.
Yeah.
It's 1835.
Shred those bills.
Run away.
Shred
them. Change your name.
Yeah.
Bye.
Where death now lives with these KP King Pest weirdos who have kind of turned their own dystopian London landscape into their own utopian hug box. Isn't that sweet?
Oh.
Little huggies going around.
Yuckies.
Huggies all around.
No, thank you.
Yeah, big hug. Okay. Said seamans stumble into one of those bubbles, which is an old undertaker's home, which has since become the Kingdom of King Pest, short for pestilence. But you know what, Stephanie? I actually really like that. Floating plume, his whole thing.
Oh yeah, what about
you know, the daisies, the silk, the scotch trim. He's not a King Pest to me. He's more of like a prince. He's a lovely prince. He's Prince King Pest. PKP.
The fits are on point.
Prince King Pest.
Prince King Pest.
Yeah.
PKP.
Yeah, he seems very lovely.
So little PP.
Well, PKP.
All right. So little PP and his pesty subjects want to enjoy all of the food. Oh Jesus.
Back here somewhere.
Okay.
I got it.
All right.
Don't worry.
Okay.
Proceed.
Back to PP. So.
PKP. Very important.
I like PP. Okay. PKP and his pesty subjects want to enjoy all of the food, drink, and sex before pest or the death inevitably takes them. Because who doesn't want to live it up?
Yeah.
I don't blame them.
No, this is very much a satire from Edgar Allan Poe here. And Edgar was, you know, he wasn't a very nice guy. Let's be honest. He didn't like very many people at all. He didn't like non-white people, but also he didn't really like white people that much either.
Well, he married his cousin.
Especially like his very young cousin. He also didn't like Andrew Jackson. So this is a satire of very, very, very far right wing contemporary concerns of disease, superstition, kings and presidential decrees. And of course, these characters actually might be a reference to out of work theater guild actors.
Why hate on the actors?
And evil. He really didn't like evil. What he perceived as evil, which was, of course, like I said, definitely non-white people, but also white people who he thought were dumb.
Okay.
Yeah, he just thought basically everybody was dumb.
Everybody except
and
him.
Yeah.
All right.
He was pretty much the, you know, he's the smart guy.
Okay. Well, back to the losers he wrote about. So, I mean, I'm sorry, our seamen. They are ordered to join the pesty ranks, right? To drink with the pests. Yeah. And when the seamen refuse, everything goes nuclear and the kingdom is flooded, but like biblically flooded. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. With the strongest drinks in the room. And while Harry does not depict all of this literally because it would just give it all away, it is beautifully foreshadowed by his illustrative depiction of PKP's flowing scotch-rimmed cape.
The daisies, right?
Yes, yeah. And the winding linen of Queen Pestilence and Anna Pest's gowns, right? And they flow along, they're ripply, some of them are sinewy in a tendril-like manner, all at the bottom third of the composition.
Right. And I really love how they look like glass shards.
Oh, yeah.
They almost look like glass shards. Like, you could imagine Harry in his studio, his glass studio, just seeing that, like, pile of, you know, glass that wasn't used, that, you know, that was kind of trimmed
scrap
off.
Scrap glass.
Yeah, the scrap glass. Kind of trimmed off and just lying there. And then they turn in, they slowly morph into that more sinewy, sort of curved line that starts to look like, you know, it's flowing alongside the ripples.
Ooh.
Really beautiful.
That's a nice way to put
it. And then King Pest's, Prince Pest's daisies on his silken cape are bobbing along. looking like lotus flowers. Beautiful, yes, beautiful. Yes. It's this beautiful moment that obscures death levitating above the table.
That's right.
And the monsters at the table, apart from my prince, King Pest, Prince Pest, Legs, Little Tarp included with those monsters, are all arguing at that table among the drinks, among the chaos. It's this great moment because they're too caught up in their own bullshit to see the bigger picture.
Oh, damn.
Death literally above them, and then the destruction of the flood that is about to commence.
Yeah, you want to be sad about everything that is inundated in the flood, but Legs and Little Tarp, they do escape, okay? And they snatch the two women pests on their way out, stepping out once again into the arguably even more dystopian real world, right? Nothing earned, nothing learned, but at least they have some lady friends
there's some,
now.
There's some gal pals.
It's okay.
Arguably. They're just like jumping ship. They're like, yeah, I guess like since our kingdom's ruined, we're gonna go with these two.
We'll snatch these two.
Yeah.
As far as Harry, we don't know enough about what was going on in his mind, and we have really tried to put the pieces together as much as we can. Mm-hmm. And you have to imagine that everything that made Harry Harry appealed to him with this commission. The tragic hand that he was dealt, the early death of his mother, the chronic illness that often kept him from working, and the illness his brother Walter would also suffer from. He lost a lot of his early works in a bombing during the Easter Rising insurrection, which led to the Irish War of Independence, not to mention World War I. Just World War I for everybody.
Yeah.
And so he's making work in a time of great instability under the whims of local and international powers. That sounds kind of familiar. Yeah.
Something we'll see again with Wanda Gogg, TBP'd.
TBP'd,
not TBKP'd, as in to be King Pest, Prince Pested. Prince King Pested. I said I was going to stop with the acronyms, and I'm still doing
keep,
it. But yeah,
keep it going.
Keep it going.
Yeah,
keep going. KG.
P-I-
I have to stop. You have to stop me. Go.
All right. So back to Harry and his drawings. He labored over them, okay? Reworking them and reworking them and reworking them until the scenes conveyed the emotional draw of the work.
Really, all the illustrations in this book are like varying levels of amazing. But this one, for some reason, like really stuck with me and you, I assume.
Yes.
The little like follow me stippling mixed into that ska trim and with the linen slash glass tendrils floating along in the bottom thirds of the composition. You know, like I said, how they look like shards and then bend into like soft linen. And then that hidden glowing skull I mentioned earlier, it's like this Calavera constellation, but it also acts as like small flecks of reflection from the coal light in the cranium of the skull.
Yeah, magical.
It's such a nice touch. That and these characters have some of the most defined faces. Mm-hmm. And that part is very much Edgar Allan Poe. But I think a lesser artist might have felt like it was a little too definitive, you know, that it didn't leave enough room for their own interpretation. Mm-hmm. We checked out a 60s or 70s comic book adaptation of King Pest. It was pretty good. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
But I think like Harry, for whatever reason, was able to really meld his work with Edgar Allan Poe's to the point where it really seemed like those are the characters that I envisioned when I read the book. And to be clear, I didn't know who the characters were when I read the book. So it was kind of like, oh, it's that character. Like I'm seeing it like be slowly illustrated in front of my brain juice. You know what I mean? As I'm, as
yeah,
I'm reading.
Yeah, for sure.
It's the perfect example of what illustration should be in my mind. Mm-hmm. Enough of an homage to Poe while staying uniquely Harry's.
And not to mention this spooky ass cover on this book. Okay. So the version that we have, right, this one right here, this face scared the shit out of me. I'm a scaredy cat. And I was home alone and this was just staring at me. And I had to cover up this
You're not
cover.
Supposed to, I'm the scared one. You're not supposed to be the scared one.
I was home alone,
all right, okay.
All rules out the window. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Absolutely terrifying. Thank you. Put it away.
All right.
Night, night.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this definitely isn't like Vincent Price or like Colin Farrell in the penguin makeup, you know? This is like a real actor. This is like a Theater Guild actor with a unique face who's been, you know, who isn't like young and hot, you know, not that Vincent Price was young or hot, but it's, you know, it's like Bonnie Ahrens. It's a Bonnie Ahrens circa David Lynch finding her and making her the trash demon in Mulholland Drive sort of situation. You know, this is a Theater Guild actor who has, you know, the specific face for the Telltale Heart. And then Harry's improvised with this repeating ticking of the heart, swirling into an acanthus tendril, which morphs into a locket, which then the tall grasses grow, and you see the old man's eyes budding from the, like, stem of, the grass. The body's buried underneath, the static of patterning. It's like we previously described before, Jinju Ito, body horror mixed with a tuberculosis fever dream. Which, of course, Stephanie, brings us to the once great and since abandoned Art Slice Museum, Division of Color Theory and Color Studies laboratory walls, filled with these like sticky cobwebs now, kind of gunking up all those beautiful pigments, turning the once like vibrantly, almost hard to look at, colorful labs, ironically, into what kind of looks like a dizzying black and white Harry Clark illustration.
Someone leave on a Bunsen burner?
Possibly. And we have a mint condition, Tales of Mystery and Imagination, House of Harrop, LLC, by Edgar Allan Poe. Just pretend this is the first edition. Harry Clark edition from 1923, pinned to the laboratory walls. It's out of frame. You can't see it. And we have to decide quickly, because these Bunsen burner exhaust fumes are really starting to permeate. Does it belong in the Art Slice Museum?
Well. What really intrigues me about Harry's work generally, but his illustrations especially, is how he crams every nook. He fills up every nook and cranny of the page, right? He leaves no inch untouched, okay? It's all intentionally placed. It is not haphazard. And it's a fantastic example of horror vacuity. And it's so fantastic, Russell, listeners, that it scratches like an itch in my brain.
Okay.
It feels really
nice little back scratch.
Yeah, for your brain. But it's also like a dopamine hit because I want to keep coming back to it, which y'all know I like a work that, you know, keeps on giving, right? So I like to keep coming back to it. And like I said, it's itching that part of my brain. Mm-hmm. But aside from the horror, when I don't want
it's
it to leave.
It's going, first it's in your cerebellum, now it's in your spine.
I don't want it to leave.
It's making its way through your bloodstream.
Yeah.
Your central nervous system.
I welcome it.
Right.
I welcome it.
Gotcha.
So
like tuberculosis.
I assume
starts in the brain,
that
goes into the central nervous system.
I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe it's vice versa. I don't know.
I work at Art Slice. Okay.
Yeah. I meant to say versa.
You know what? Some people in this country would recognize that as their regional dialect. Anyway, aside from the horror vacui, I love how he applies his same wild, freaky-ass imagination to his secular works as much as his religious commissions.
Okay. Yeah, it's almost like he's creating this like fantasy, this whole like fantasy world, right? This fantasy epic that is big enough to encompass like parts from the Bible in his stained glass works, Edgar Allan Poe, Hans Christian Andersen, Faust. Like they all feel like they could be part of one world, like, you know, like David Lynch's Dune.
Yeah.
Or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
like Saint Veronica and Duchess Anna Pest and Meta Mephistopheles could like be mainlining like the spice together.
Okay.
And also, you know, getting in the same car, going to the tailor together.
Okay, I love that.
Meta Mephistopheles is in the backseat, I think. He's got a wingspan.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
I trust
Anyway,
you.
It's Harry's world.
Okay, love it. Love that. Speaking of all that, though, it reminds me of a few things we've covered before, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So our episode on the Great Surrealist Paint-Off, right? Every artist.
Oh, yeah.
Every artist had to depict St. Anthony in their own way, and they took him into their world.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is kind of like Harry. Harry has a filter, a Harry filter.
Some of those demons do kind of look like the pre-Renaissance, like St. Anthony.
Oh, medieval. Yeah, medieval for sure. Yes. Yes. And from what I can gather, it seems to be the Irish way, right? To be able to coexist with your gods and goddesses and just intermingle all of it. Anything goes.
In the same car. Go to the tailor together. Stop by your drug dealer. Get
Ride
the spice.
Or dice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but also this is very much like the Mexican artists that we've covered, right? Especially Diego. We always talk about Diego.
Or Posada,
we always find
Posada
a way.
Too.
Posada too. Yeah. Yes, yes. Diego, though, he painted unique facial features for every one of his figures. Like they were based on a real person, which is actually another contrast to Aubrey Beardsley. His figures are vague, but they're like intentionally vague, which is fine. But Harry's, though, they're all unique and hyper-specific like Diego's. They all have their own features, and they might reference Poe in this case, but it's with his own spin, right? The Harry filter.
Right. And I think it seems like the more Harry became comfortable with his own visual language as his style progressed, the more it was capable of just enveloping anything in it, anything and everything in it.
Yes. But I think on top of all of that, you know that he's clocked so many hours of observation to be able to get that specific and to be able to create all of those worlds. And he would have gotten all that from the theater, right? Because honestly, where else would he have gotten all of those reference points? Very specific, very imaginative reference points. But back to Harry's day. We mentioned the Irish War of Independence a few times and TLDR. The majority of Ireland wanted to be separate from England, understandably, the UK or the United Kingdom, which led to the separation of Northern Ireland, which remains part of the United Kingdom. But the rest of Ireland, the bottom two thirds, has since become known as the Republic of Ireland. It's its own country. And lots more happened between then and into the 1990s. During Harry's time in the 1920s, life was not done dealing him a dirty hand. Harry was extremely ill. He was diagnosed with tuberculosis, like his mother and his brother Walter. And in a desperate attempt to get some relief, he goes all the way to a TB clinic in Switzerland, like 2,000 miles away, and he's still working on illustrations whenever he has the strength. Now, the political climate in the aftermath of the war definitely sealed the fate and payment of his last commission, the Geneva Window, which was his magnum opus. Afraid of stirring up controversy, it was hidden away from the public for decades. By the time the news had reached Harry, there wasn't anything that he could do. And unable to make it back home in time to insist on the payment he was promised.
And Harry wasn't wealthy, we should say that. He needed this money for his family. Mm-hmm. He needed this money for his business. He needed to get that payment that he was promised.
Yeah. And he passed away soon after at the age of 41 there at the clinic without getting paid. While the stained glass works are hard to come by outside of Ireland.
Yeah, in Miami, for some reason. Or Jersey. Or New Jersey. Just the two best places.
So Harry's books are much more accessible. Like, you can check it out at your library. You can find a copy on eBay.
Yeah, one of the things that's so great about illustration is that you can actually, like, own it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, varying degrees of quality, of course, of course. But you can own it and you can open it up. You can get your, I don't want to call out anybody specifically, but you can get your greasy Costco pizza fingerprints all over it if you want to.
Feel attacked.
It's not just behind like a screen or in like some remote Miami-based location. It's different than most works of art in this way, mm-hmm. that you can actually hold it, you can actually cradle it, you can flip through it.
Sneeze on it.
Yeah. Whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Put your TB hands all over it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I love that you can have such a tactile experience with it, which basically is our way of saying, y'all, it's going to be in the ASM library.
Of course.
To answer your question in such a long-winded way.
Yeah, the bunsen burner fumes are getting rough. And, you know, greasy fingers allowed. Greasy fingers allowed, yes. Ahem, Stephanie. You know, I think I'll probably give you and any other greasy-fingered patrons, I'm not calling you out specifically, but let's say you had greasy fingers. You know, maybe we'll have some of those, like, very cheap, crinkly plastic gloves to put on.
As long as they're biodegradable.
Well, we'll see. So the librarian can give you a stink face across the Biblioteca stacks. The stacks of books.
All right.
And listeners, we would love to hear your favorite Harry Clark book illustration is and why. What do you like about it? Does it match the story well? Does it divert from the story effectively? Is it just immersive? Are you immersed in the world, in the language? Just let us know. We want to know all the Harry deets.
Also, speaking of Harry, we also want to know if there is one you particularly dislike.
Yeah, oh, okay.
And why?
Can I put my hands down now?
No.
Okay.
Now you may.
Okay, so it's going in the Art Slice Museum, and we need to go to the Art Slice Pantry on the way out here. We hope you've enjoyed this part of our creature double feature. There's a second part to that double feature. And it's coming up next. It's Vondagog.
Yes, which we have something super duper special lined up. Okay.
You want to watch this one?
Yes, you do. But first, you want to like and subscribe. Sure. Okay. And leave us a 5-star review on your pod player of choice.
Glad you liked it. I'm really glad you liked it.
Fine start. It's okay.
Hey. You're burning a little bit.
You're looking better. You're looking better.
You are. Gotcha.
Yeah, it hurts. Okay, there is a lot happening here right now. We're going to go to the Art Slice Pantry, and then that's it. That's the end of the episode. Come back for the next one.
Vamanos.
All right, vamanos. When you're working on an art piece and trying to fill just every inch of the canvas with some kind of mark, or standing in front of a mirror trying to layer patterned tops with a patterned cropped pants, you might be blessed with the affliction that has become known as horror vacui, or vacui, or vacui, a Latin phrase meaning fear of empty space. It sounds spooky, but the phrase came from ancient scientists lounging around campfires on rock slab deck chairs, passing around stone bowls, and swapping frightening thoughts like, why do blood run in arms?
Why do air fill chest? Because they're caveman scientists. They're caveman scientists. That's the rock slab chairs, the slab deck chairs, passing around a bowl. I mean, okay. But basically, why does matter seem to fill empty spaces? Because they were 5th century caveman scientists, doctors, really. Very prestigious. They went to universities. That same term would later be used by an art critic to derisively describe the maximalist sensibilities of Victorian interior design, but could just as easily describe Bernini's over-the-top detail stuffing that became known as Baroque. The Pre-Raphaelites' dedication to painting every blade of grass, or Rob Liefeld's illustrating abs on abs on abs, and sometimes on shoulders. As a horror vacui sufferer myself, I do think it's best to try and fight your instincts, if only to push your work into places you wouldn't have discovered otherwise, and better understand how to use that impulsive superpower effectively. But ask yourself, why should horror vacui be derisive? Or why should horror vacui be derisive? Some prefer the musky warmth of a secondhand store filled to the ceilings with zines, VHSs, broken Bucky O'Hare action figures, and basically like a Manhattan Island-sized population of silverfish. When you intentionally fill every nook, corner, and cranny of an artwork with purposeful detail, you are one in a long line of artists, the likes of arabesque designers and illuminated manuscripters who intentionally filled their spaces edge to edge with beautiful marks.